Now, some digital efforts to rescue dying languages. There are about 7,000 spoken languages in the world, and linguists project as many as half of them may disappear by the end of the century. Some language activists are trying to prevent that with high-tech tools, as we hear from Tom Bonsi of the Northwest News Network.
Members of the Native American Siletz tribe on the Oregon coast take pride in a language they say is as old as time itself. But today, you can count the number of fluent speakers on one hand. Bud Lane is one of them.
We had linguists that had come in and done assessments of our people and our language, and they labeled it, I'll never forget this term, moribund, meaning it was headed for the ash heap of history.
The tribal council was determined not to let that happen. Lane realized he would need outside help to revive the Siletz language. Subsequently, several National Geographic fellows helped him record 14,000 words and phrases in his native tongue.
Let's dance out in front.
Che nasat nitash.
Many Siletz words describe foods and basket making, showing how language entwines with culture.
Baby basket.
Kayu.
Baby basket laces.
Kayu matlhwash.
The word translations are now available online, along with lesson plans, as part of a so-called talking dictionary. The site is hosted by Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. There, linguistics professor David Harrison has also posted talking dictionaries for seven other highly endangered languages from around the world.
This is what I like to call the flip side of globalization, or the positive value of globalization. We hear a lot about how globalization exerts negative pressures on small cultures to assimilate.
But Harrison says language activists now have modern digital tools with which to go on the offensive, including iPhone apps, YouTube videos, and Facebook pages. Harrison and a colleague in Oregon have mapped hotspots for endangered Aboriginal languages. One region is the Pacific Northwest. Also judged at high risk are tribal languages in Oklahoma and the U.S. Southwest. In Canada's far north, the Inuit people are struggling to preserve their native language. Part of their strategy was to work with Microsoft to translate the ubiquitous Windows operating system and Office software into Inuktitut.
Instead of file, you'll see Indy. Instead of home, it'll say Pigialfik. Instead of save, it says Yagayakli and stuff like that.
Project leader Gavin Nesbitt says the programming group had to invent new words to cover all the terms in Windows and Word document menus.
So many people will spend their entire day sitting in front of a computer, and if you're sitting in front of your computer in English all the day, then that just reinforces English. If you're now using it in an institute, it's just reinforcing that this is your language.
That's why Microsoft has also worked with language activists in New Zealand, Spain, and Wales to translate its software into Maori, Basque, Catalan, and Welsh, respectively. Back in Oregon, Siletz language teacher Bud Lane cautions that technology alone cannot save endangered languages.
Nothing takes the place of speakers speaking to other speakers and to people that are learning, but this bridges a gap that was just sorely needed in our community and in our tribe.
Lane says one sign the tide is turning is when he sees tribal youth texting each other in Siletz. For NPR News, I'm Tom Bonsi.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Carbonite, providing automatic online backup to protect photos, music, and other computer files from loss. Details at carbonite.com.
This is NPR News.
Petitions have been a common form of protest throughout history, but gone are the days of having to use handwritten letters to bring attention to a cause. Now, petitions are online. One company called Change.org has contributed to the phenomenon. NPR's Teresa Tomasoni reports how the company's website allows people to start change in their communities with a few clicks of a mouse.
When Jenny Holcomb's 15-year-old daughter Emily was charged with felony assault in Hamilton, Alabama, for slapping a teacher, she was shocked.
The sheriff's department was standing there, served me papers, and wanted to serve Emily papers until I told them that, you know, she was a child with autism that was nonverbal.
Afterwards, Holcomb says a friend wrote about the incident on Facebook.
And from Facebook, it spreaded. And that's when Lydia Brown contacted me and asked me, you know, if she could do a petition to have the charges and stuff dropped on Emily.
The woman who wrote the petition, Lydia Brown, is autistic herself. She's been an advocate for people with the disorder since high school. But the 18-year-old Georgetown University student had never written a petition before.
So I was just kind of like, I don't know how I should do this. I don't know if there's a template anywhere.
Some friends suggested she use change.org, a website which lets people write petitions and collect electronic signatures online to protest or support causes that interest them.
And I wrote this petition that came across in this very legalese, very formal kind of we affirm that, therefore we demand that kind of format.
Brown later realized most petitions on the site are not written so formally. Most are written as first-person letters that answer three basic questions.
What you want to change, who has the power to change that, and why others should join you.
Ben Rattray is the founder and CEO of Change.org. The 31-year-old came up with the idea as a senior in college.
When I was at Stanford, there's this combined interest both in entrepreneurship and in political social change.
So in 2007, he decided to make Change.org into a profitable business. Large organizations like the Sierra Club and Oxfam pay to have their petitions promoted on the site. And the revenues from those petitions allow everyone else to use the site for free. Alan Weber is an industry analyst. He sees Change.org as a leading example of what digital social action should look like. But, he says, it's important to realize its success is wrapped up in the rise of other social media.
I think it's part of an ecosystem. People are going to share petitions, but they're going to share those petitions via Facebook or via Twitter.
There have been at least 1,000 successful petitions, according to Change.org. The one that got the most attention was the petition against Bank of America's plan to charge debit card fees. Rattray acknowledges that many of the campaigns launched on his site are supported by other organizations and people outside of his company. For instance, Jenny Holcomb had already hired a lawyer to help her fight the charges against her daughter before Lydia Brown started the petition drive.
I think eventually we would have got, you know, what we wanted to, but I don't think it would have been as soon.
Within a few days of the petition launch, the felony assault charges were dropped against her daughter. Lydia Brown has since written two more petitions on Change.org related to autism. Teresa Tomasoni, NPR News.
Robin Farzad writes today that the story you just heard is no big deal. The senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek joins me now from New York City. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you, Robert.
And why did you write today that this, and I quote, supposedly blockbuster news is no biggie?
It's such a tiny speck. It's such a tiny check that Apple will be writing as a portion of its balance sheet. I mean, after all of this PR, press release, victory lap running in Cupertino, this is just a 1.8% dividend yield. Apple has $100 billion in cash. It has, you know, it might well double that amount in 2 years, even after paying this dividend, because the cash is coming in so rapidly. Its products are commanding such product lust that people are willing to fork over really high margin amounts, even in a weak economy.
Now, I understand that Apple is unique in many respects, but in this case, it's at the top of a list of businesses that have huge stockpiles of cash: Microsoft, Google, Cisco, Pfizer, ExxonMobil, Johnson & Johnson. First, is this phenomenon very unusual? And if so, why are companies holding so much cash? What's in it for them?
Well, a huge part of this is particular to Apple in that it's been such a breathtaking comeback. It's a case of innovate or die. Let's not forget that 15 years ago, Apple was 2 months away from bankruptcy. You know, the late Steve Jobs would be looking down at all this and saying, wow, my company is so huge that it has an embarrassment of riches. Really, the only reason that Apple is coming out and paying this is to placate a handful of shareholders and the press. So Tim Cook doesn't have to deal with this question conference call after conference call. After all, the stock is near an all-time high. It's worth more than any other company in the world. It's not like they need to genuflect in front of a whole new set of investors and beg them to come on board.
How much of that stockpile of cash at Apple or the smaller stockpiles at other big companies, how much of it has to do with tax policy and parking money overseas because if it were repatriated, they'd have to pay taxes on it?
There is a certain amount of that. For example, Apple has close to 60% of its cash pile. It's on track to have that this year overseas, and you have to you get docked if you want to repatriate that back home. So that is obviously a consideration. But you look at Apple's nemesis, Microsoft, it's not as easy for Microsoft to go out there and pay a huge dividend because it's really tantamount to them to admitting defeat. They really have to figure out whether they want to give money back to investors and call it a day, or if they're going to make one or two more really good tries at innovating new products to catch up with Apple. And similarly with Pfizer. Pfizer was a company that 10 or 15 years ago was innovating, had a really impressive pipeline of pharmaceutical products. Now it's just been acquiring other companies for the past 5, 6, 7 years. And, you know, there's almost a stage of, you remember Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of death and dying, mm-hmm. and there's some companies that are in denial and in acceptance. And to the extent that you're going to pay out a lot of cash, it could signal to the world that you're no longer an innovator. So I think many CEOs are leery of just handing the money over.
So is what Apple has done a statement of confidence, the confidence that Apple has in Apple, or is there any greater confidence about the economy as a whole that might be some sort of a model for other companies?
Really, Apple, my impression is they were just looking to flick off people who were bothering them, like kind of here, I'm throwing you a bone, just get out of my way. This is not a transformational event. Yes, the stock was up $8 or $10 today, but the majority of what Apple's going to be doing going forward is still innovating, is still plowing back its cash flow into new products, taking on the world in all these different ways, and at the same time banking a lot of cash. So if anything, this is only going to become a bigger embarrassment of riches for them because they're paying out a fraction, I think, of what they're going to be taking in as this company gets even bigger.
Robin Farzad, senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thanks a lot, Robin.
My pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Apple, the world's most valuable company, has announced that it's going to share the wealth. For the first time since the mid-1990s, the company will pay a dividend to its shareholders. Demand for iPads, iPhones, and other iProducts has been so strong that by the end of last year, Apple had amassed a cash hoard of nearly $100 billion. NPR's Steve Henn reports investors have been clamoring for a dividend and were happy with the news.
Apple had an enviable problem. It's not too many companies today that have more cash than they know what to do with.
In fiscal year 11, our cash increased by $31 billion.
Peter Oppenheimer is Apple's chief financial officer.
During the first quarter of fiscal year 12, we generated another $16 billion.
To appreciate the scale of Apple's conundrum, consider this. In the last 3 months of 2011, Apple was generating more than $1 billion in profit, free and clear, each and every week. By the end of the year, it had enough cash on hand to buy Goldman Sachs outright. And even after that, it would have had almost enough cash left over to buy General Motors, too. It's not that Apple hasn't been spending. It has. Over the past few years, Apple spent several billion locking down critical parts in supplies for the iPhone and iPad. It spent several hundred million buying a couple small startups. And it spent aggressively opening dozens of new stores around the world.
Even with these investments, we can maintain a war chest for strategic opportunities and have plenty of cash to run our business.
Apple CEO Tim Cook.
So we are going to initiate a dividend and share repurchase program.
Starting later this year, Apple will spend about $5 billion annually buying back its existing stock. This stock buyback program is relatively small and really just intended to offset any new stock Apple gives out to its employees. Apple will also begin paying a dividend of $2.65 a share this summer. That will cost the company about $10 billion in cash each year.
It really opens the stock up to a much broader group of investors, you know, principally value and dividend-oriented mutual funds.
John Lutz helps manage a mutual fund that's been invested in Apple for years. Apple's stock price has been rising so fast that lots of institutional investors, like Lutz, can't really buy any more.
This is a problem a lot of growth managers have. You know, they're simply capped out in terms of how large of a position Apple can represent in their portfolio.
But by paying a dividend, a whole new group of institutional investors can start buying Apple stock. These are folks who cater to retirees and other people who need to earn some income from their investments. Peter Oppenheimer, Apple's CFO, says the company will soon pay out more than $2.5 billion to investors each quarter,
which would make us one of the highest dividend payers in the United States.
But as a percentage of its earnings, Apple is paying less in dividends than other technology giants like Microsoft and Cisco. And most analysts expect the cash to keep piling up. By the end of the year, it's likely Apple will have more than $100 billion stashed away in offshore accounts. And Tim Cook said this morning, Apple had a record-breaking weekend of iPad sales.
The stock price is up 45% year-to-date. It's up tenfold over the last 6 years. And it's up that because they've been absolutely knocking the cover off the ball.
Lutz says the news this morning that the stock will begin paying dividends is just a cherry on top. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court said police had overstepped when they planted a GPS tracker on a suspected drug dealer's car without getting any search warrant. It is another in a long line of cases testing the balance between personal privacy versus the needs of law enforcement. The decision set off alarm bells inside the FBI, where officials are trying to figure out whether they need to change the way they do business. NPR's Kerry Johnson has the report.
Before the Supreme Court ruling in January, the FBI had 3,000 GPS tracking devices in the field. Just in case, government lawyers scrambled to get search warrants for weeks before the decision, working to convince judges they had probable cause to believe crimes were taking place. But after the ruling, agents still had to turn off 250 devices that they couldn't turn back on. FBI Director Robert Mueller told Congress the ruling will change the way agents work.
It will inhibit our ability to use this in a number of surveillances where it has been tremendously beneficial. We have a number of people in the United States whom we could not indict. There's not probable cause to indict them or to arrest them who present a threat of terrorism. Articulated, maybe up on the internet, may have purchased a gun, but have taken no particular steps to take a terrorist act.
Before the high court decision, the FBI would have deployed electronic trackers to monitor those people. Now teams of 6 or 8 agents have to watch them, taxing the agency's resources. Andrew Weissman is the top lawyer at the FBI. He says the Supreme Court made a distinction about the Fourth Amendment, which guards against unreasonable searches and seizures, ruling that computers that follow suspects are much more intrusive than people doing the same thing.
The court essentially is saying that you have an expectation of privacy. Even though if it was done by humans, there would be no violation. But because it's done by machines, it is.
In the Supreme Court case, FBI agents investigating drug crimes secretly put a GPS tracker on a Jeep belonging to Antoine Jones. They kept it there for weeks without getting approval from a judge. Catherine Crump works at the American Civil Liberties Union.
In the Jones case, the Supreme Court held that reasonable people do not expect the government to track their location by attaching a GPS device to the bottom of the car for, in that case, 28 days.
The full implications of the decision are still coming into focus. Weissman says he's telling FBI agents,
when in doubt, to obtain a warrant to protect your investigation.
But he says that's not always possible.
And the problem with that is that a search warrant requires probable cause to be shown. And many of these techniques are things that you use in order to establish probable cause.
Government lawyers say the Supreme Court decision reaches well beyond electronic trackers. Solicitor General Don Verrilli put it this way at a recent Georgetown University conference.
That decision is reverberating very quickly into areas that I'm sure lots of you care about, national security, cybersecurity, privacy more generally.
The Justice Department's predicting new fights over cars that come with GPS already installed and cameras the FBI sticks on poles to catch drug dealers and speeders. Then there's the big enchilada, cell phone information. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit will hear a case this year about whether the government can get access to cell phone location information without a warrant. You might be surprised to know it, but every 8 seconds or so, your cell phone can transmit information to a local cell tower, signaling where you are. Crump of the ACLU says that's a lot more intrusive than putting a tracker on someone's car.
After all, a cell phone is something you carry with you wherever you go.
As for Antoine Jones, whose case made Supreme Court history, prosecutors say they'll try him again, maybe using some of the location information from his cell phone. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The Justice Department's inbox was flooded this week by hundreds of thousands of people demanding a federal investigation of the shooting. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports that social media and black media brought this case to wider attention.
Trayvon Martin was shot on February 26, but it was last Friday's release of the 911 tapes from the night of his death that made the dead teen a top story in the mainstream media and kept him there. This is one of the callers on that tape.
I heard screaming and then a gunshot.
Okay. Well, we have an officer there. Did you hear any more gunshots since you've been on the phone with me?
But I don't hear any more screaming either.
By the end of the evening, 17-year-old Trayvon was dead, shot in the chest by neighborhood watch volunteer George Zimmerman, who told the dispatcher moments before Martin looked suspicious. When authorities reached Martin's body, they found a can of iced tea and a small bag of candy. Zimmerman claimed self-defense, citing Florida's Stand Your Ground law. No charges have been filed, and the outrage in black communities across the country was instant. Although the shooting would become national news a few weeks later, the anger immediately flowed through black talk radio, black newspapers, and blogs. There was even a song about the incident by rapper Jaziri X, whose Trayvon claimed an overzealous Zimmerman jumped to deadly conclusions.
George Zimmerman, neighborhood block captain, loaded Glock strapped in, fake cop has been, got out the car, ignored what the cops asked him, they always get away, this time that will not happen.
Syndicated columnist George Curry says the black media has a long history of highlighting anti-black violence, which mainstream media often picks up on later.
The black press plays a unique role because they know right away and can recognize these kind of stories and the value of them.
Curry believes that part of the lag between when black and mainstream media began covering the Martin shooting can be accounted for by the community's different interactions with law enforcement.
I think that stems from the fact that white have a different experience with police than African Americans and Latinos. To whites, many whites, police are Mr. Friendly. To African Americans and Latinos, he's Mr. Unfriendly.
Rashad Robinson is executive director of Color of Change, an online civil rights organization. Color of Change got almost 400,000 signatures forwarded to Attorney General Eric Holder's office in just a few days. Robinson believes this kind of mobilization is important beyond this one case.
But also that for all the Trayvons out there who we may not know yet, that we can start the work of changing our culture to ensure that justice is served and that folks in power understand that people will not just be quiet when these type of injustices happen.
Before the Justice Department became involved in the Martin investigation, the Obama White House had been fairly quiet on the subject, other than expressing its condolences and concern. Here's Press Secretary Jay Carney on Monday afternoon.
Our thoughts and prayers go out to Trayvon Martin's family, but obviously we're not going to wade into a local law enforcement matter.
A reporter then asked about an earlier well-known racial confrontation that President Obama stepped in to mediate.
You know, the case of Professor Gates up in Cambridge pales compared to this, and the president did speak out about that.
I don't have any conversations to report to you.
That night, the Justice Department announced it would investigate the Martin shooting.
It becomes harder and harder for politicians to not pay attention.
Attorney Lauren Gelman specializes in social media issues for the firm BlurryEdge.com. Gelman says online campaigns by Color of Change and other organizations make a difference.
It goes from being an issue for just one community to being a national issue.
Which is exactly what social media users are counting on in Trayvon Martin's case. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.